Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 373, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening to the show and would like to support us, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, Jason Heaton. Hey Jason, how are we doing?
Oh, since Monday, since we talked last, I'm doing okay. We're in kind of a weird time warp scenario here where today's main topic was recorded a couple of weeks ago, and we're recording this so well over a week before it's going to run. So it's kind of a weird scenario, but yeah, so far so good. It's a beautiful day here. It's actually going to be quite summery. We'll see if that lasts, but yeah. How about you? You're still fighting some jet lag, I'm sure.
I'm still just still in the throes of figuring out, you know, the post plan for Watches and Wonders and getting stories up and trying to get some sleep. And I'm off to Vancouver tomorrow. You're off to California this weekend. So we kind of had like a 3-day window to, you know, as I like to say, put a bow on the megasode, but also to prep the sort of front and back of the episode for today's chat with Victor Vescovo, obviously a legendary explorer, a man who's been to the bottom of the ocean, et cetera, et cetera. We will get to that in just a moment. Today's kind of chit chat up top isn't going to be super timely again, because this doesn't run for a little while. And because we just did some chit chat a couple days ago, you're off to California. It looks like you're going to be swinging by, Windup SF. Are you excited to be out there?
Yeah, it's going to be, I think I mentioned this in the last episode, I've got quite a varied lineup of stuff to do. We're going to some opera performances in LA on this coming weekend, which is now in the past for people listening. And then driving north up the coast, kind of stopping a few places along the way, including hopefully a dive if conditions hold around Big Sur, mm-hmm. with some folks that everyone will be familiar with, and I don't want to give anything away there. And then, ending up eventually in San Francisco a week later with the second of my girlfriend's daughters who lives there, and we'll be hanging out in the city. And then it just seemed like the timing could be such that I'll wind up San Francisco. So,
nice,
you know, in a very civilian
That's great.
Capacity, just kind of walk the show and say hi to some people. So yeah, if anyone's around and they see me and recognize me, or at least hear my voice, say hi. I'd love to chat with some folks.
For sure. Yeah, no, I think that's great. And yeah, like you said, some of this will be past tense, and some in this scenario, I'm about to leave for the Vancouver Timepiece Show and for a weekend in Vancouver, and then a week seeing my brother in rural BC. By the time this comes out, I'll actually be almost heading home from all of that. The only other thing that I did want to talk about that is timely, but you know, it didn't align with any of the other recordings that we had necessarily, is another really exciting thing I saw in Geneva that actually came out. It could have been on the last episode, and we were just so kind of stacked up with watches that we didn't get to it. But this is the new Ming Polymesh. If you'll allow me to get very nerdy and watchy here right at the start. So the Polymesh came out last year with a curved end link meant for Ming's own watches.
Yeah.
Because Ming recognizes that they're not the only brand out there, and they work with a series of brands through their Horological Alliance that don't use curved, that wouldn't need curved spring bars, they're now making the same strap, but with a straight end link.
Yeah.
Oh, and, cool. You know, I met up with Logan Baker, who now works with Ming, and he had a sample of this, and I put it on my aerospace, and man, it cost me 1,500 Swiss francs immediately.
Wow.
There is no strap like this.
Watch. I was wondering where you were going to put this. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. So I have one in the mail. They launched, as we're recording this, it launches tomorrow. When you hear this, it will be a week old. You will have seen the story on Hodinkee, and I'm sure this will be all over the Slack. Is it an expensive thing? Yeah. It's like almost $2,000 once you probably get it here. More in Canadian. That's more than my aerospace cost, to be fair, or very similar. It'll be right in the same zone. Yeah. I couldn't care less. This is the most exciting strap bracelet scenario I've come across in years.
Yeah,
I've never experienced anything quite like it. It's heavy and dense, but moves like a fabric.
Huh.
The closest thing I could say is, like, I guess chain mail, but imagine if the link was a fraction of a millimeter across, and if the tolerances were like in the microns, which they are.
Yeah.
If you don't know the strap and you missed it, it's an additive. So to borrow the easiest term, it's a 3D printed strap. It's technically laser sintered titanium powder in grade 5. There's like nearly 1,800 components. It's printed in place. Hmm. So there's no pins. There's no screws.
Oh,
the only thing added to the strap that includes like the buckle and the hinge in the buckle is printed as such.
Yeah.
They add a spring bar, and then the entire thing is sort of hand finished and processed so that there's no little burrs. If you're into 3D printing, you know that can be a thing regardless of what you're printing with. I just, it's a unique experience. I've never come across anything like it. It looks really cool on the aerospace. I published a very quick wrist shot or pair of wrist shots in the story announcing it that would have gone live last week.
Huh.
So by all means, swing by Hodinkee if you didn't get a chance to see that. I have one coming in the mail for like a long-term sort of test to check out, and that'll be the one that I'm also buying from Ming, unless for some reason I end up not liking it very much. But I spent about 24 hours with one on the aerospace. I fell asleep with it on, totally forgot the watch was on my wrist when I went to bed that night. It's a marvelous, weird, fantastic thing that feels like a magic trick.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So I've got a few questions. I'm looking at the photo on Ming's website. They don't have the straight end one. They've got the curved version on their website. But I'm curious about that buckle. What's the deal with the hinge on the buckle? How does that work? It's like two squares, and then there's this triangular piece, and then there's the pin. And I'm just wondering how the strap feeds through that.
So it feeds in and under like an Apple strap.
Okay. Okay.
And then there's a little tang that.
So you don't need keepers.
No keepers needed.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It goes in and under like an Apple strap or like some of the other sports straps we've seen in the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a little kind of shark fin tab on the underside that just keeps the strap from. It's so smooth and soft and kind of. Almost, it has a lot of structure, but at the same time, it's like fabric.
Yeah.
Like a heavy metal fabric. I don't know how to really describe it. It's a crazy thing to, and like watching people check it out for the first time and like run their fingers through it, or if you drape it over the edge of a table and it like fully conforms to the curvature of a table, you can kind of spiral it up on itself like a ribbon.
Yeah.
It's really something else. But yeah, the strap, you feed it through so that it catches on the pin buckle, and then you kind of channel it through that part under your wrist or under the overpass, and there's a little tab that kind of keeps it in place. So then when you want to take it off, you get a finger in there and just lift it off of that tab and it just slides right out.
Fantastic. Okay, so my next question is, I'm scheming now of any titanium watches I have. Yeah,
what could you put one on?
I mean, I only have...
It's only 20 millimeters right now. I think they didn't say this. I believe it was mentioned that 22 is possible as well.
Would it be possible, having handled this, to make a pass-through single-piece strap out of this? I mean, it'd probably scratch up the case back. That would be the...
Yeah, I think that it would cause a lot of abrasion.
Yeah.
And it's quite a thin, the strap is strong enough that if it was, you know, if it caught on something, it will break the spring bar before the strap. It's actually a lot stronger than you'd think.
Yeah.
But I have to imagine if you did, you know, to put it on an FXD, for example.
Yeah.
I think mechanically it could probably go through there. It might lift quite a bit as it makes that second turn, like the one to go down and then the one against the back of the case.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a little bit of tension there. And I have to just think over time, you would either cause quite a lot of like metal on metal rubbing, which titanium's not great with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And two, you might just have it where it has a little bit of tension there and that's the exact point that you're like squeezing as you tighten it down.
Yeah. Well, that saves me some money.
Yeah, sure. I think you're as far as the FXD goes, I think one of the few things I don't think this strap could work on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I also think it might be too little strap thickness for a watch like that.
Really? Wow.
Like it suits the...
Well, I was thinking CWN, actually, in 20.
Oh, CWN 1 being 20 for sure. I'll give it a try. I'll try and feed a piece of the one that I get in and see how it kind of looks and works.
Yeah, right.
Who knows? Maybe they would make a single pass option in the future, like a titanium printed NATO.
Yeah, right.
Essentially,
right.
Which would be nuts.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was blanking on the CWN1. Shame on me. But yeah, I figured you were leaning. I think with the CWN1, it's a little bit less bulky of a case than the FXD. That could work. It's such a nice match for. Just how thin the aerospace is.
Yeah. Can't wait to see how it looks on the aerospace. That's probably amazing.
Let me see. I can send you a picture of the aerospace.
Oh, look at it on the aerospace. Oh my God.
It's like techie, and because of the patterning, it's a little bit baroque. And like I was already kind of in the market to buy another bracelet for the aerospace, which would get me the UTC module.
Yeah.
And those are more than the cost of the watch as well to get a bracelet and the module. And I hadn't come across a titanium option that was really suited. So maybe I'm not going to get my UTC module. Maybe this is the way that it ends up. But I'm very happy with this combo.
Ooh, boy, is that sharp. Oh, that is gorgeous. Right?
Super nerdy.
Yeah.
It's super nerdy. But so this is how I'll be wearing
it. It makes it even more nerdy that it's not an aerospace.
Yeah. Oh, and I showed it to a couple people, like, because I was walking around and I said, you know, don't take a picture or whatever, but you can check it out. And everybody goes like, oh, it's like a perfect match for this silly watch. And some people love the aerospace when they see it.
Yeah.
And other people you could see, like, especially walking around Geneva during Watches and Wonders, they're like, right. A freaking quartz watch, you knob. So it is, that is what it is. But yeah, I'm pumped about this. And I promise I'm not being paid by Ming. This is not an ad. I'm paying for the strap if I end up keeping it, I promise. And that's my comfort zone for these sorts of things. They offered to send one without a receipt, like without an invoice, simply because I hadn't had a lot of time to decide if I meshed with it, and it's not an inexpensive strap, certainly. So that's where we're at with that one. But yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it. I guess I tried to get it to Vancouver in time, and who knows, maybe by the time this episode airs, I will have had it in Vancouver. But it looks like I'm gonna miss it by a day or two in Vancouver, and I'll have to forward it back to Toronto. So do what we got to do with the shipping.
All right, so
that's what I've got to add a little bit of color at the top of the show. And you've got a little update on the best TGN episode tournament bracket. How's that shaping up, to the best of our knowledge, as some of this is still up in the air, obviously, due to the time frame?
We didn't plan well in terms of the announcements here, because we actually don't know who's made it into the championship round, even though we should, because as we record this, they've moved on from the final four, and championship voting is open until May 4th. So get in there and cast your votes. There was an interesting final four showdown, and I'm curious to see who's going to make it to the championship round. But since we're recording this a week ahead of time, not sure. That's the suspense is killing me. But yeah, go ahead and vote in the championship round. Again, it's open until May 4th, and jump into Slack and for more details about that and get the updates. And a big thanks to our intrepid mod on Slack, Jackson B, who spearheaded this whole kind of diversion from our absences from the show the past couple of weeks. So it's really cool. It's been really fun to kind of revisit some of these old episodes and see what people are digging up from the archives. So thanks, Jackson, for that. And yeah, go check it out.
Fabulous. Yeah, looking forward to seeing how that shapes up and having maybe a little bit more of an in-depth convo following the finalization of the championship round of voting. So that's super fun.
Yeah.
What do you say we jump into some wrist check and then on to a chat with Victor?
Yeah, definitely. I've got on my Zin 144S. This is the limited edition that I bought from Tom Place last September when we were all sitting in your kitchen having some whiskey, and I made one of those decisions. We've probably all been there,
sure.
And no regrets so far. It's been a great watch. I put it back on the Porsche design bracelet, which just looks so perfect on this thing. I had toyed with the idea of wearing this watch for the Defender Trophy, given its ruggedness and the chronograph functionality. I was going to throw it on a NATO, but there's something about that case shape that just doesn't work quite well for me on a NATO. I haven't quite found the right NATO, especially with black hardware, because I'm kind of picky about that sort of thing. Yeah. So, you know, if anyone's got any ideas of kind of a perfect strap for this watch that, you know, kind of more of a sporty strap, you know, let me know on Slack, you know, tag me and post up a picture or a link. I feel like I'm a little bit behind the curve on what's out there in terms of straps these days. So if anyone's got any ideas for that watch, it'd be great. But in the meantime, it's looking really good on the Porsche design bracelet. So that's what I've got on.
Killer. Yeah. I love that case on a bracelet for sure. That's typically how I wore mine. I was able to scrounge up a kind of a suitable bracelet for my GMT back in the day, and it always kind of suited it nicely. So that's a good call.
What are you wearing?
Speaking of watches that work really well on a specific strap, I'm wearing my Arkin Alterum Vancouver Speakeasy. I was, you know, just kind of packing my bag for Vancouver and kind of threw it on, and it's just a delight. It's a nice size. I love the rubber strap. It's probably the only watch I have where I wear it on a black rubber strap.
Oh, yeah.
I think it suits it quite nicely. I mean, I've had this watch now for nearly a year. I got it at Vancouver last year. as part of Ken's kind of West Coast, Vancouver, San Francisco speakeasy thing. And that's with the green Cerakote case and the kind of sand-colored GMT hand. I love this watch. I've worn it a ton. It was one of my favorite summer watches last year. And yeah, it's a treat to have it on. So it's that's what's on wrist today.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and coincidentally, I'm wearing my Arkin heavy cotton T-shirt as we're recording this. Ken's got some good soft goods, too, if you're keen on a cap or a shirt. Check that out, too. But you'll be seeing Ken in Vancouver here in a few days.
I should see him as early as tomorrow. I believe wow. We both get in roughly, or he might already be there. I don't even know. Huh. But I should see him a couple times this weekend. I'm looking forward to it, along with a couple of the other Jasons in my life. And whether it's a Gallup, Lim, Hutton, I'm looking forward to getting a revolver. There's a RZE gear swap on Saturday morning. There's a Take's got a whole like camera and coffees things going on Friday. Man, so I'm going to be kid in a candy shop. It looks like the weather's going to be really good too.
Wow.
It's like a little bit cloudy in 15 for the whole weekend right now on the weather app. So I'm very much excited to get out there. I have a very early flight tomorrow, but it'll be a joy to get out there. I just hope I have some internet, because I've got some stuff I got to get done.
All right. Sounds like a great trip.
But hey, speaking of all sorts of adventures, how about we get into the main topic, which is a chat with none other than Victor Vescovo. We've got his bio here from Wikipedia. And Victor Vescovo is a private investor and explorer who became the first person in history to climb Mount Everest, dive to the bottom of the ocean, and visit space. You got to do all three of those. It's some sort of a wild triple crown, if I may editorialize during our intro here. He served 20 years in the U.S. Navy Reserve as an intelligence officer, retiring in 2013 as a commander. In 2017, he completed the Explorer's Grand Slam, which requires climbing the highest peak on all seven of the world's continents, including Mount Everest, and skiing at least 100 kilometers to the North and South Poles. He piloted the first repeated dives to the ocean's deepest point, Challenger Deep, in the Pacific's Mariana Trench, now 15 times. And in August 2019, he became the first person to visit the Five Deeps, the deepest point in all five of the world's oceans. He's clearly a completionist, is what we're learning here, and not a guy that's going to be outdone by many of his peers, certainly. Victor now has personally explored the bottom of 17 deep ocean trenches and has made three dives to the Titanic, including the only solo dive ever made to the shipwreck. In 2025, the U.S. Navy announced that a new ocean surveillance vessel would be named after him. He is also a commercially rated multi-engine jet, seaplane, and helicopter pilot, a certified submersible test pilot, and recently flew into space on Blue Origin's new Shepard rocket. If that's not enough for you...
Something's wrong, yeah.
But let's get into this chat between Jason and Victor Vescovo, all about his exploits, some of which I'm sure we just listed. I can't wait for this one. It's going to be great.
All right, Victor Vescovo, welcome to the Gray NATO. We're so happy to have you, and I just want to throw out an acknowledgement and a thanks to our mutual friend David Concannon for connecting us. David was a previous guest on TGN, and we had a lot of fun with him. And we also had, I guess you're a bit of an heir apparent to, or a spiritual descendant of Don Walsh, who was on our show a couple of years ago as well. So welcome. We're so happy to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Those are both great individuals, and happy to be here.
I would suspect most of our listeners are aware of who you are from your exploits, the Five Deeps in particular, and some of your work with Omega, being that we're a bunch of watch nerds. But for those that maybe don't know your background, or actually I don't know a lot about your background prior to kind of when you came on the scene more famously, so maybe you can give a little bit of a background, because I think people often see explorers, people that have gotten some renown, as just sort of appearing fully fledged, you know, in their element and doing what they do without like hearing about the background. Like, I'm just curious how a guy like you, you know, came out of the U.S. Navy intelligence service and some investing stuff and whatever, and how you got into exploration and the stuff you do now. If you can give a elevator speech or a little bit of a background, that'd be great.
Sure. I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and I think I was born with the genetic code that made me extremely curious. And I've been cited as saying the most dangerous thing that ever happened to me was when I got my first bicycle when I was 6 years old, because I tended to vanish for very long periods of time exploring my city here in Texas, in Dallas. And, but I led a couple of, in some respects, parallel lives as I was growing up in my 20s and 30s. I was a finance guy primarily, although I did some consulting as well. I worked in investment banking in New York for a while, and then I went into private equity. I co-founded a private equity firm in around the year 2000 and did that for about 22 years or so. But in parallel to that, I was approached when I was in business school in my late 20s to join the U.S. Navy Reserves in intelligence. So I had a parallel life in finance, but I also did quite a bit of activity, more than the norm, in Navy circles. And I actually served for 20 years and ended up retiring as a commander. The first 10 years, I was a targeting officer. So I worked with the air crews on how to plan missions and bomb targets and then do the battle damage assessment. I was involved in the Kosovo conflict pretty heavily. And then after 9/11 happened, I was cross-trained into counterterrorism because one of my languages is Arabic, and that was useful in that, as you can imagine. But at the same time, I mean, for me, I'm not the kind of guy that would go on vacation and go hang out at a pool or what have you. I would always want to do something very, very active. And so from the time I was in my early 20s, I got very heavily into high altitude mountain climbing, you know, formal training, really high peaks, very technical. And I did that for like 2 decades. And I just gradually, you know, worked my way up to more and more extreme environments, accumulating to eventually going to Mount Everest and being able to summit that peak in 2010. But then I started, you know, getting close to my 40s or so, and that's more of a young person's game. And so I said, what's something else that's actually really challenging, but isn't so brutally physical as high altitude mountaineering? And that's when I realized in 2015 that no human being had been to the bottom of 4 of our world's oceans. And that just was like a personal affront to me, because we certainly had the technology to do it. You know, humans had been to the bottom of Challenger Deep twice, you know, James Cameron in 2022, and then Don Walsh and Jacques Picard in 1960. So we had the tech. It's just that no government or no individual had really applied themselves to do it. So, you know, I come from a culture where it's like, well, you know, if you're not going to do it, you know, why not? You know, I said the 5 most dangerous words in the English language, you know, how hard could it be? And that began a 5 or 6 year endeavor to design and build what at the time, and I still think is, the most advanced deep diving submersible ever built. And I personally, I'm a pilot, have been since I was 18. So I said, you know, how hard could it be to fly a submarine versus a helicopter? You know, so I underwent that training, and yeah, we did the 5 deeps and then 16 other deep ocean trenches over the next 4 years of heavily diving that submersible and doing a lot of science, a lot of exploration. And that's what I guess I got some degree of notoriety for. And then because of that and having a very successful private equity career, I was able to get on board of a Blue Origin flight and was in the capsule of the 5th manned flight on Blue Origin's New Shepard and went into space. So I ended up becoming the first person to go to the bottom of the ocean, to Mount Everest, and into space, which was something I had never really planned on doing. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so all of these endeavors they're very disparate. It's very, very different activities, but all involve a considerable level of risk. And yet you don't present yourself as kind of a base jumper, adrenaline junkie. And correct me if I'm wrong, but like, would you say risk is something you seek out? Or I mean, there's a lot of risk mitigation that you have to do, of course, but
that's exactly it. And yeah, people look at me going, oh my gosh, you do so many dangerous things, but I am the first person away from recklessness. There's a very fine line. You can do very dangerous things, but you can mitigate risk as much as you can and make them repeatable in some respects, like a stunt person does. I mean, they do extremely dangerous things, but they study the problem. They practice it. They get the proper training. They add as much technology as they can to be able to do the mission, and they make it look easy, right? And that's, in some respects, what I did in my mountaineering career and then eventually in diving as well. Yes, these are not the most safe things to do, but if you have the proper training and the right mental attitude and you're not one to panic and you treat things very, you know, rationally, yes, you can do these things. Now, the risk is never zero, but, you know, and that gets into some of the things I'm still working on that are pretty out there in terms of extreme environments. But again, I've got the training and now the background that I think I can manage the risk reasonably well while still pushing the envelope.
Yeah. And are you someone who kind of, once you've conquered something or achieved a goal, you are I don't want to say quick to move on, but you seek the next challenge. Before we started recording a couple of weeks ago when we connected, you know, you reminded me that you've sold your submersible. You've kind of moved on from that aspect of your career. Are you kind of done?
Not really. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a marine biologist. I'm not a professional mountain climber. I'm a technology developer. I mean, that's what I do now. I'm a venture capitalist. I have my own fund. I make, you know, pretty extreme investments in venture, but I developed the limiting factor and we dove it hard for 4 years. What we were really doing was we were showing what it could do. No submersible had ever done anything remotely like that. And it took several years to perfect it. That was really bleeding edge technology. And at the beginning, a couple of things didn't work, let's put it that way, but we perfected it to the point where I was able to sell it to a marine research organization. And that's all they do now is they dive it all over the world and do really cool science stuff. And now what I'm thinking long-term in the next 5 or 10 years is building the next generation of a submersible that'll be even more advanced than the one that we built, taking all the learnings that we got from the first one and apply it to the next one. But I'm also working on an aviation project. I'm working on a diving project that's scuba related. I'm doing a lot of venture stuff. So I just move on from one challenge to the next because that's what keeps me interested. And I think that's why we're here, is to keep pushing the envelope.
So as someone who has traveled to space and been to the bottom of the sea, I'm curious about, I guess I have this, I've been a space buff for a very long time, but I have this bit of a strong reaction to this idea that we need to look to the heavens. We need to go, we need to colonize Mars. We need to, like, I don't want to say, it feels like there's this movement towards not abandoning Earth, but finding ways to, like, leave Earth and explore space, almost at the expense of, like, forgetting that the ocean is so unexplored. And I get the feeling you're someone who, you're an ocean lover. I mean, I've read quotes by you. I've read things, you know. What's your feeling about space versus the ocean?
I reject that, this or that. I'm always a both person. I believe we have the resources, the intellectual curiosity to pursue both, as I personally have and continue to do. I mean, I mentioned I'm a venture capitalist. I'm invested in a company called Astroforge. We're trying to figure out how to mine asteroids. But at the same time, I'm trying to develop the next generation deep diving submersible. I believe that we need to learn and inhabit both domains for the survival of the species. You know, getting off planet is not a bad idea. You know, we're one massive asteroid strike away from having a really, really bad species level event. And the ocean, however, to your point, is 70% of our planet. Most of the life on planet Earth is in the ocean. It's not on land. Yeah. And we have to make sure that we do not continue treating it in such a horrific way that it ends up destabilizing our lives. So it's not or, it's both. And I believe we have the resources and the energy to do both, as I am.
Yeah. Interesting about mining asteroids, that that seems like a very ambitious challenge.
Well, we can go any number of avenues down the venture capital investments I make. That's just one vector of, wow, that's kind of out there, Victor. But it's actually an engineering issue. We have landed and captured material from asteroids 3 times in human history. The Japanese did it twice and we did it once. Now, those were billion-dollar government-level projects. But now we're trying to commercialize it, get it at a much lower price point, and recover precious metals. And yes, this could be a 10-year or even a 50-year project, but we are moving the needle forward on how to do this. And if we do, it has, I mean, quite literally transformational impacts on the planet and our access to rare resources like, you know, platinum group metals. You know, you even just think about the asteroid that's out there called Psyche. It's this massive metal asteroid. I mean, if you could somehow get there and mine that asteroid, you're kind of done for certain parts of the periodic table that you would never have to mine on Earth again, because that's where it came from. All the metal on Earth came from space. We're just trying to cut out the middleman.
What's your take on deep sea mining? I'm fairly against it.
I'm very passionately against it. And I was published in Time with an op-ed against it. I'm, in many respects, you know, one of the voices that has been most vocal about being against it. I understand it has significant environmental damages, and one can argue that versus the need for the minerals, et cetera. But for me, I don't think it's going to work. I think the people that are strong proponents of deep sea mining, I don't think no one has ever operated heavy mining equipment at the bottom of the ocean at 4,000 plus meters, deeper than the Titanic is. I think they're being extremely optimistic about the operating environment and how their economics will actually be when they actually try to retrieve polymetallic nodules. And the other deep, deep, dark secret of polymetallic nodule collection, which they're contemplating doing, is you only get four metals from them. That's it. It's not like you get like 20 or 30 metals that's going to solve all these problems. You only get four, and cobalt and nickel are two of them. And those are semi-rare, but not that rare. And they're becoming less important as we get new chemistries for batteries, which was the original purpose of deep sea mining. And the other two are copper and manganese, which are relatively plentiful in the Earth's crust. So the issue is, I think, as I've said, that deep sea mining is an interesting idea, but it is environmentally destructive. It's technologically very difficult, and it is going to address a minerals problem that existed 10 years ago. So I don't see the point. And I think that, like many companies, once their original investment thesis doesn't pan out, they don't just one day say, oh, well, you know, time moved on. Here's your money back. We'll stop doing what we're doing. No, they keep flogging their business case until it fails, until they run out of money. And I think that's kind of where they are now. They've done a total pivot away from saying we need to mine the seafloor for the electrification of the world with, you know, electric vehicles. That's no longer that viable a case. So now they're saying, oh, it's for national security. China, China, China. You know, we need to have our own minerals and process them ourselves. But that's a stretch. And I don't think it's going to work. So that's really why I'm very strongly against it. I just don't think it's going to work.
It's timely that we're speaking a day after Artemis II rounded the backside of the moon. This episode won't go up until late April, but we're speaking on April 7th. And I think you mentioned you were, well, we'll bring it around to watches. You were wearing a special watch while they're up there. But also your discussion of mining minerals on asteroids, I think there's some plan to exploit, if you will, the moon for similar purposes. Any thoughts on that? Do you think the moon is a viable place?
Well, I will say I am wearing, and I'm wearing it right now. You can't see me, but I've got my Omega X33, which they're wearing them on the Artemis, a different version, but it's the same model. And I'm going to keep wearing it until they make it back safely. And this watch was actually given to me by Charlie Duke, who was the youngest person to walk on the moon. He gave this timepiece to me. This is a new build. It's not his, but this is a watch that Omega gave to Charlie to give to me before I went up on my new Shepard flight about 4 years ago. So this watch was given to me by the youngest moonwalker ever, which is kind of cool.
That's great.
It's a great timepiece. But mining, you know, the moon is interesting. It's not like mining the asteroids. The issue with asteroids is about 1% of them are metal asteroids. They're called class M, and they have a lot of iron, but they also have precious metals. So they can be very valuable to mine. And you don't have to go all the way to the asteroid belt to mine the asteroids. These are actually in orbit in kind of this similar area to where Artemis is now. Now, the moon is much more limited in what you can mine. Now, the most valuable thing you can probably mine is simply water. Because if you have water and if you have solar or nuclear power, you can split the water and get oxygen and hydrogen. Oxygen to breathe, hydrogen as a fuel. It's great. That's for that. But rare metals, like you would mine an asteroid, you don't really get, because the moon is primarily made up of a regolith, which is just more carbon and not a lot of useful stuff other than for maybe construction. And there's helium-3 on the moon, which some would argue could become a very valuable resource for nuclear fusion. So there are some companies that are looking at mining the moon, but that's more for government kind of contracting and use. We're going pure commercial. We're building our business case for Astroforge to actually go out and mine precious metals from asteroids. I mean, it's a single large suitcase of precious metals from an asteroid is worth over $50 million. So it more than pays for the launch and all the support infrastructure. But more than that, it's about the capability. And that's really what we're trying to do, is just go to an asteroid, land on it, show that we can actually mine it. And then it becomes just a matter of scaling it. And I mean, that's a trillion-dollar company if you can do that. It would make, not in the near term, but in 50 or 100 years, you would make mining on Earth inefficient and obsolete, because you can go to asteroids where they're at 10 or even 100 times the concentration they are on Earth. Why wouldn't you mine it? And with SpaceX's Starship, and I'm an investor in SpaceX, that's dramatically lowering the cost to put payloads into space. So when Starship gets rocking and rolling with the 100+ ships that Elon wants to build, you're talking about putting stuff into orbit at $10 a kilogram. You can put massive mining complexes into space for the cost of putting a big satellite up there now. Well, yeah, why wouldn't you go to a near-Earth asteroid and mine the hell out of it and just drop it literally back onto Earth?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Jeez.
Space I don't forget. Yeah. I had a nice meal with the CEO of Omega, Reynald Aishelman. And I told him that I was an investor in Astroforge. I said, hey, Reynald, by the way, if we mine some precious metals from an asteroid and we bring them back, would you like to put a bid on some of the metal for your timepieces? He just stared right at me and said, yes. And his chief commercial officer was going, wait, we haven't even talked about price. And Reynald was like, I don't care. We want that.
That's
material.
Right in our wheelhouse. That's
yeah,
great.
I'll get you
the special edition spin out from that. Yeah, that's
yeah. The first platinum dial watch from an asteroid coming from Omega. That's my hope. So I'm going to try and make that happen one day.
That's amazing. Tell me a little bit how I think I know some lore around your interest in Omega. You know, there's a certain different brand, of course, that we all know and love as well, but that have had the history with deep ocean stuff, specifically with the Challenger Deep back with Don Walsh and Picard being Rolex. But how did you settle on Omega?
I heard Don was upset about that. I heard that, you know, he did not authorize. He was the Navy commander of that vessel. And Jacques Picard strapped a Rolex to the outside of the sub. He did not approve that, nor did the Navy. So that was kind of a pirate kind of thing. I didn't know that until recently. Don never told me that, but other reliable people did. And it makes sense to me as a naval officer. There's no way you can commercialize a mission like that. Yeah. But they did. And, you know, it is what it is. But they kind of snuck one in. I was a private expedition, so I could do whatever I wanted on my sub. So I took down Omega.
Yeah.
But no, the story there is true. It's been widely reported. But one of the things I learned in training to be a submersible pilot was we had to have all this type of safety gear inside the submersible in case it got entangled or there was a problem. And one thing that they absolutely required was an analog timepiece. It couldn't be in any way connected to the submersible in case the power failed or there was some other failure. So I said, okay. And you know, I said, I've got a decent watch. I don't even remember what it was at the time, but I said, yeah, let's get a hardcore, you know, dedicated diving watch that will keep perfect time, et cetera. And I went to my local boutique in Omega because they had Seamaster and I just did a little bit of research. They made the first commercial diving watch. I went, okay, I'll get an Omega. It's a great brand and that would work. I was kind of in a hurry, to be quite frank. I went to the boutique and I'm looking at the different Seamasters and I picked one out that was titanium, same material that my sub was made out of. I liked that symmetry. Yeah. And I'll never forget the salesperson, very nice young lady. She said, oh, do you dive? I went, yeah, a little bit. I said, really? What kind of diving do you do? Do you scuba? I went, no, I'm going to take a submersible down to the bottom of the Atlantic in a couple of weeks. She's like, oh, that's nice. Okay. What color would you like? You know, I don't think she quite believed me. And so I literally just bought at retail an Omega Seamaster 300-meter watch, 600, sorry. And then I dove to the bottom of the Atlantic several weeks later. And I think that got picked up by the folks in BN. And within a week, I had an email from Reynold and the others there. They're saying, "Hey, can you come to Switzerland? We want to talk to you about what you're doing." And I went, "Sure." So I went over there. We had a nice lunch, and then they showed me the factory. They said, "Yeah, we'd really like to partner with you on your expedition to all five of the world's oceans and even the Challenger Deep." I said, "That sounds great." They said, "Yeah, we'd love to." And here's another little story about that was the head of product development of Omega, Gregory Kistling, who's now the CEO of Bruges. He's a great guy. He was there and he presented what were going to be commemorative watches with, you know, engraved case backs to dive to Challenger Deep and do the five deeps. And I'll never forget Reynald, the CEO, you know, looked at him saying, "This is very nice. This is very appropriate, but I think we can do better. I think we need a timepiece that will be outside of the submersible." And I could see Gregory's face just go white. And then they both turned to me.
Short.
Exactly. Right? They both turned to me and said, "When are you diving again?" And this was early January. I said, "I'm diving in late April."
Wow.
And exactly. And they were like, "Oh, okay." And Gregory didn't speak a lot for the rest of the day. The wheels in his head were just turning. And one critical thing that happened was just getting the material that was qualified to go down to, you know, basically 11,000 meters. And we ended up using the offcuts from my submersible that were titanium. Mm. They were already qualified. So we got the coupons from that metal from my actual submersible. That became the cases for the three ultra deep professionals, X1, X2, and X3. And that shaved off, you know, months of qualification and forging time. They could go right into machining and, you know, unbelievably, they were able to make all three timepieces and they worked spectacularly.
Yeah. I was struck by, I was at the, if you remember, there was, you were at that event in London. It was at the British Museum, a really short event, but then there was a dinner in the evening. And I remember you made the rounds with that watch from table to table and you were letting people kind of hold it. And I remember I've got a very blurry photo on my phone. I wish it was a better photo, but a blurry photo of it on my wrist. And that thing was, it was, I mean, not something you'd wear, but it was kind of wearable. It was, and it was really cool. It was really neat. And then of course now they've come out with a commercial version of it, which,
that's a 6,000 meter, not 11,000.
Right,
so
right,
I'd love for them to keep pushing the technology where it eventually becomes rated for 11,000. We'll see how that turns out. But so that was part of the deal, that in taking all three timepieces down, I got to keep one. So I got to keep X2, the 2X3. But I guess this is more a time or better time than any to tell you some of the news I have about that particular timepiece.
Yeah.
So the full name is the Omega Seamaster Planet Ocean Ultra Deep Professional X2. That's the watch that I own. That is, all three of them went down to the bottom of Challenger Deep, 10,935 meters, on my first dive that I did in 2019. I then took mine down an additional 10 times. So mine has been down to the bottom of the ocean 11 times. The other two have been down once. Omega was totally fine with them just going down once. Because one of them actually got stuck on the bottom for about 2 days and they didn't want that to happen again. And mine went down 11 times. And since then, I actually went into space about 4 years ago in 2022. And I took that timepiece in the capsule with me above the Kármán line, above 100,000 kilometers. So it's been into space. But most recently, last year in May, a very good friend of mine who is an expert mountaineer, he took the X2 to the summit of Everest.
Wow.
And then in December of this past year, 2025, Blue Origin allowed the watch to be strapped onto the booster of New Shepard 37, and it went into space again, but this time outside the pressure capsule.
Wow.
So this is now the only timepiece in history that has been to the bottom of the ocean and did so 11 times, has been into space inside and outside of a capsule and to the summit of Everest.
Wow.
Wow.
It's a well-traveled timepiece.
Is it still ticking? Is it still keeping reasonably good time?
The thing, thing is a tank.
Yeah. Wow.
It's in a safe deposit box here in Dallas.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Man, you're hard on your watches.
They like to travel.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, right.
So show me another watch that has that kind of provenance in terms of reach.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I also have the one, I have the Seamaster that I wore on my wrist when I did all my dives. So that timepiece, you know, has been, I also took it into space. I took it down. It's been down 15 times to Challenger Deep, because that's how many times I've personally been down there, but it's been in 17 deep ocean trenches, and it was on every dive I ever made for 4 years. So that's also a very well-traveled watch.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have, you bought, I believe it was at auction, right? Don Walsh's Aquastar that he wore in the Trieste back in 1960. How did that come about?
Well, Don had to, you know, he needed a timepiece to take down with him as well, I imagine, for exactly the same reason. So he went to the PX, and I can't remember if it was in San Diego or Guam, but at the Navy PX, he bought an Aquastar, and he wore it on his trip, the one trip he made to the bottom of Challenger Deep. And then it came up for auction after Don passed, and I thought it really should, for lack of a better phraseology, stay in the family. You know, I'm a fellow naval officer. I know the family. I took his son down to Challenger Deep in the same place that Don did in 1960. And I had the means, so I entered the auction and I paid what I had to pay to acquire the watch. My intention is not to keep it in some vault. I'm working with the Navy because I think they're rebuilding the exhibit of the Trieste at their museum. And when that is complete, I would like to kind of permanent loan to them to have the watch as part of the exhibit.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
I think there's a, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's some interesting overlap with AquaStar and Omega, because the founder of AquaStar, who was working for, they were a sub-brand of Jean Richard back in the early 60s. And when they started making diving watches, they called that line of watches AquaStar. And they had a guy named Frederic Robert head up AquaStar. And he was an avid diver and sailor. And so all they made were diving and sailing watches. And then he left AquaStar in, I believe, 69 or 70 and went to Omega. And he was the guy who was behind the development of a lot of those iconic early 70s weird-shaped Omega dive watches, like the Ploprof and some of the 1,000-meter Seamasters and things like that. So I always like that sort of, I guess, serendipity, you know, the or synchronicity, I guess, between AquaStar and Omega. And that's great.
In a way, there was a handoff from Don, who had his AquaStar, and he did the first dive. And then I came along. I was the second American to go down. And then I had an Omega. And it all worked out.
So let's talk a little further about ocean exploration. And you know, we talked a bit about space, but you have some interesting work going on with specifically ocean floor mapping. And I read you sent me a presentation, and I'll fully admit there was a lot that I didn't understand about it. in layman's terms, talk about what you're up to with that and what it's called and whatever.
When I started my project to go to the bottom of the five oceans, I viewed it primarily, you know, as a personal adventure, but it was a technical endeavor to build the most advanced diving submersible that could do that. They could go to Challenger Deep repeatedly and safely, which had never been done before. So I'm more of a technologist, not a scientist. In the process of the 4 years of intensive diving with that submersible, you know, I brought along all sorts of scientists and oceanographers to go along for the ride. And as you would expect, they infected my rather curious mind with all the things that they were doing, and spending time with them day after day on the ship. Yeah, I got really interested in ocean science. And the first statistic that just burned into my mind was 71% of planet Earth is ocean, which is, it's the vast majority of our own planet.
Yeah.
75% of it is completely unexplored and completely unmapped. Actually, less than 0.01% is actually visually viewed. The rest is all sonar. So 3/4 of our ocean is still completely unmapped. So if you do the math, that means half of planet Earth, mostly ocean, is completely unexplored. It's hard to do because radio doesn't work through water, and the ocean is very opaque and it's very deep. It's a tough problem. Well, give me a tough problem, I'm going to want to try and figure out how to make it happen. And that's what I've been doing for the past 2 years. Since I sold the diving system, I've been trying to figure out how can we more efficiently map the seafloor. I mean, we can do it technically, but it just requires an enormous amount of resources and it's slow. Yeah. How can we speed it up, make it cheaper? And I think I've come upon the best solution that we have using modern technology. And that's why over the next 2 years, I'm going to be building a dedicated surface vessel that's actually quite compact, but it has the most powerful sonar you can put on a civilian vessel. And hopefully it'll be out there operating in 2 years, mapping the seafloor, you know, a couple of million square kilometers per year. And hopefully there are governments and nonprofit organizations or even individuals that would also want to buy a ship to help the cause. I'm going to buy and build and operate the first one. Hopefully like-minded people that are even wealthier than I am can say, hey, that's a really good project. I want to get involved. And then we can do it much faster, hopefully in our lifetimes, if we have 4 or 5 of these vessels. But then there are other things I'm developing as well, which are autonomous aircraft that would be used to map the shallow areas. Different depths of the ocean require different technical solutions. And that's the other thing I think I bring to the table, which was historically, you know, governments that are mapping the seafloor, they're not really that cost conscious. So they use a bulldozer to, you know, to scrape the soil. I mean, it's just not efficient. There are better ways to do it. And that's what I'm now doing as a private individual. I can move faster. I'm very cost conscious, and sometimes that yields the best solution. You know, it wasn't the government that invented aircraft. It was the Wilbur and Orville Wright bicycle guys in Ohio that figured out how to make powered flight. And sometimes the private sector gets the stuff done.
Yeah. So my familiarity with shipwreck hunting leads to what might be a naive question, but is the sonar similar? I mean, I've seen the results of a sonar scan looking for shipwrecks, and you can, it's this bottom contours, and then you see this anomaly that's shaped like a ship, and it's like, lo and behold, we found something. What you're talking about is a much more powerful version of the same type of thing, right? You're bouncing sound waves off the what's below and then creating a map. Yeah.
Yeah. It's still sonar, but they're, let's just say they're tuned very differently. When you're looking for a shipwreck, you've got to do that at very short range with very high resolution sonar, usually from autonomous vehicles that are being operated. You know, you're only a couple hundred meters off the seafloor, or it's going to get lost in the noise. The sonar you use to map the seafloor is much more coarse. It doesn't have near the detail, but it can certainly see a seamount or an underwater ridge or a canyon. Yeah. That it's good at. I'm just trying to get the first draft of the ocean's seafloor. I'm not trying to get the minute details where you can find shipwrecks. We don't even have the map of, you know, where the Grand Canyon is underwater. I mean, goodness, you got to start somewhere. So that's the plan.
Aside from scientific curiosity and just the idea of just exploring the planet, why is it important?
I know, it's funny. That's the immediate question. So why are you going to so much trouble? What's the point? You're asking that from someone who's, you know, frankly, an explorer. We have huge blank spaces on the map of our own planet. We have better maps of Mars and the moon than we do of our own planet. And you're asking, you know, what's the point? Well, exploration for exploration's sake. And the other way I'm now kind of positioning it is, can you guarantee me that if we mapped the 75% of the seafloor that we have not mapped, that we will find nothing interesting? Mm. That makes no sense. We all know with that sheer amount of exploration to be done, we're going to find something interesting. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it has any utility at all. I'm not a scientist. What I do know is that at least my job in my existence is to try and fill in the blank spots of the map. That's what makes me happy. That's obviously, I think, what I was meant to do. And so I'm going to try and do it.
Yeah. Yeah. In the presentation that you sent me about this project, I was looking at the craft, the vessel that you're building to do this. And it looks fairly humble. I mean, it doesn't look very big. And I believe it says that there can be a crew of one or two people. This is not some giant, you know, research vessel kind of thing. How long is this thing? What are we talking here?
It's 23 meters. And that's pretty short. But the issue is, according to international maritime regulations, below 23 meters, you can have a single pilot. So that's the issue. We didn't design this as normal oceanographic research vessels are designed, which is, okay, it needs to do this. Oh, and by the way, it needs to do this. Oh, and it needs to do this. And you end up with these 100-meter vessels that have a crew of 40. Well, that's massively expensive. I learned that directly when I had my own research vessel, and my minimal crew was like 16 people. This thing cost an enormous amount just to be at dock. So I started from the other principle, which was, okay, start with the sonar. What's the largest, most powerful sonar I can buy? And then I built the smallest, most efficient ship to house it. I approached it from the other end. And I ended up with a vessel that's going to push the boundaries of regulation in terms of semi-autonomous operation. But we have so much more capability now with sensors, with AI, and everything to keep the ship safe. And we have autonomous vessels out at sea now that I think we can get it done. So again, I'm pushing the boundaries, not just of raw tech, but also operating principles and insurance and international regulations at sea and all that stuff to build an incredibly efficient vessel that can map the seafloor at 1/10 the cost of what it costs even for a good ship today. And with that, when you start making things that inexpensive, people will buy more of it. Governments and nonprofits will say, well, gosh, if it was going to cost us $10 million to map the shoreline of Hawaii, and now it costs one, we'll do that. And it's supply and demand. I'm a trained as an economist. Make something cheap enough, it's going to get done.
Yeah.
At least that's my theory. We haven't even talked about de-extinction.
Yeah, let's go there first.
Many people start with that one. I'm invested. Yeah. I was one of the early investors in a company called Colossal Biosciences. I know the CEO. He's a Dallas guy. He contacted me several years ago because he wanted to go on an expedition. And I said, well, what are you working on? He's saying, well, I got a new startup. We're trying to figure out how to de-extinct extinct animals like the woolly mammoth. And I said, oh, talk to me about that. And
this is the dire wolf thing, isn't it? Okay. Yes.
And we're making good progress on other species as well. So yeah, again, it's about pushing the boundaries of what is possible. I have a theory that if something doesn't violate the laws of physics, it's simply a matter of engineering resources and time. Mm. You'll figure it out. Doesn't mean it's easier, that it'll be profitable, but it can be done. And initially I wasn't going to invest, but I talked to his scientific team. I looked at the problem pretty extensively for several months. And then I said, this is right at the edge of what we could do as a species. And so I invested in and Ben, to his credit, builds amazing teams, and they've been able to, it's not a pure dire wolf. And I think that the purists out there are going to go, oh, that's not a real dire wolf. It's a gray wolf with a little bit of dire wolf DNA. Well, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and eats like a duck, it's a duck. These things are white. They are bigger than any gray wolf I've ever seen. And they seem to look a lot like what we think they should look like. And they are certainly not gray wolves. So they are a chimera, I think is the technical term. But really the value of colossal biosciences and de-extinction, that's the headline, attention-grabbing thing. What the company really is, they are becoming the masters of genetic engineering at like a seriously high level, way out in front of anybody. And that has obviously some concerns of what you do with that information, but the medical advances that we can make with that kind of capability are profound. You can see a world 10 or 20 years from now where we have individualized genetic therapies to cure diseases that were completely unapproachable even 10 or 15 years ago. And that's really what we're trying to do, you know, using genetics to help humanity and also bring back species that we killed off, humans, that should not have become extinct. And I think it's a great company. And Ben's a great CEO.
As an investor in some of these companies, what type of investor are you? What sort of involvement do you have? Are you pretty hands-off? Do you like to get your hands dirty? I guess it depends on the company and who you're working with, but.
I run the full spectrum. I am a completely passive investor in certain investments where I can't add that much. But in one of my investments, I'm actually the CEO of a company. I'm CEO of a biotech company that's trying to develop genetic cures for a couple of incurable diseases that reside in the human nervous system. I've been working on that for 8 years with a science team based in Seattle. And so it just depends how I can add value and how much bandwidth I have.
Yeah.
I stay busy.
So, that's a good segue, because my earlier question before we talked about Colossal was, when you wake up in the morning, how do you prioritize your days and your weeks? Like, I think that's another thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is kind of with somebody in your position who's very accomplished and is just doing a lot of things at a high level, what is a typical day or week like? Would you describe yourself as a type A? I get 3 hours of sleep. I get up at 4 in the morning and read 7 newspapers. You know, I mean, what's your life like?
I'm not that inefficient. I view people that operate that way. I don't think it's sustainable. No, I mean, I sleep 8 hours a day. It's about prioritization. It really is. You know, you can fill up your day with all sorts of stuff. You can be distracted, or maybe it makes you feel good about yourself if you're constantly scheduled out every 30 minutes. I reserve hours of downtime just so I can do research or just relax or go work out. Mm-hmm. Because I guess maybe if I have a superpower, it's being able to effectively delegate those things that only I can make a call on, like writing checks, making an investment decision. Yeah, I'm going to spend the time to do that. But all the other minutiae of business and communications, I will try and delegate that out. And I tend to be very efficient in communications, writing and verbal and otherwise. And that's just how I've been trained. And it's working.
Yeah. One other thing on our list here that you told me that might be of interest is this new interest in exploratory cave diving. Tell me about that.
Well, it's funny. My career as an explorer, kind of the accidental explorer, where I just wanted to get out in the world and see it when I was in my 20s and 30s. And that led me to high altitude mountaineering. And I just love it. And I'm doing less of it now because I'm older and it's much more dangerous and I have no desire to die. That took me to the oceans. But that took me into the ocean. And then I've done that for 5 years hardcore, which I loved because I loved the whole technological aspect of it. I could write checks that other people couldn't write. So I could actually build a titanium submersible. What else am I going to do with the money? You know, buy a big party yacht? No, I want to do something that's actually, you know, technologically significant and moves us forward as a species, like my other investments. This one I just took a direct role in. And then I had the great fortune to go into space. And yes, I was payload. I wasn't piloting the spaceship as much as I would have liked to. But there, I believe that the more we go into space and the more we have people paying to go into space, it'll become more regular. It'll become safer. It'll become less expensive, because I think only good things happen from people going to space because of the so-called overview effect, where you have this psychological appreciation for the Earth when you see it from space. Now, that being said, I've now fallen into two other realms of exploration, again, kind of by accident, and I call them the interstitial layers, the boundaries between land, sea, and space. The boundary between space and land is the stratosphere. And, you know, I was reading an article, and the head of the FAI, which is a Swiss-based organization that holds aviation records, the head of that institution said, was asked, you know, what record do you want to see broken in aviation? And he said, I'd love to see the altitude record for piston engine aircraft, because that's been held since 1938 and we haven't broken it yet, because we developed jets, and the jets just blew through them. But so all piston technology kind of stopped, and that put a seed in my head. Well, okay, now I'm trying to develop what would be the highest altitude stratospheric aircraft ever built that's powered by a piston engine, and I'm going to fly it. Okay. So I've got that going on. And then I was approached by two of the world's expert cave divers, and they said, yeah, we have this idea for some things we want to do in ultra cave diving, and you seem like the kind of person that not only would want to help fund the expedition, but would participate with us and undertake the year plus training to do deep cave dives. It's very dangerous. And I said, sure. So, you know, over the last several weeks, I've done some initial training with them. I think they were testing me out as well to see if I would freak out in a cave and if I could do the procedures and have a level head. And I think I did fine. So now I'm on this multi-year process. Instead of going on vacation, drinking pina coladas on a beach, I'm going to go out with my diving team and we're going to go train how to cave dive, trimix, helium, oxygen, you know, exploratory cave dives. I mean, what else am I going to do? That sounds awesome. And I'll be wearing my dive watches, you know, it's a great pairing for my good friends with Omega. And I know I keep saying Omega, and I'm not just some, you know, shill. I truly believe in their products. They're great guys and gals at Omega. And I love, we have this symbiotic, you know, personal relationship where I do some interesting things. They have amazing timepieces, and I just like doing it. I don't have to do it. And it's the only, it's the only brand I'm really associated with.
Yeah, you've never struck me as a shill for Omega or otherwise. I just think you just strike me as an enthusiast who stumbled upon Omega, and then they started to support you, and it's a symbiotic relationship that just works for both of you.
And and tested the other ones. I mean, to me, that's what I do. And they seemed much easier to work with, and I have direct access to their people and their engineers. Yeah. So yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
But I thought you gave up mountaineering because you didn't want to die and it was too dangerous. So cave diving is, by some measures, the most dangerous sport on the planet.
Well, cave diving is much more cerebral. It doesn't require physical strength or even a little bit of dexterity, but it's different. High altitude mountaineering, you've got to be hardcore cut. You got to be in shape. And if things go sideways, it literally is a matter of life and death about your physical strength and your endurance. Mm-hmm. And that degrades over time. I'm a realist. But in cave diving, it's very quiet. You know, you're neutrally buoyant. You don't have to be an Arnold Schwarzenegger to survive a cave dive. You just have to be extremely calm, very methodical, and plan everything, have backups. It's much more like going into space.
Wow. Okay. Well, we've blown through 50 minutes here, and I want to respect your time. And I there was a question I was going to say, like, what's next for you? And I don't need to ask that, because I think you have enough for the next two decades that'll keep you busy. So we don't even need to ask that question, but I just appreciate your time and thanks so much for joining on the Graynado, and all the best. I can't wait. And I'm sure all of our listeners will concur that it's just exciting to watch what you're up to, because it's never dull.
I appreciate it. Well, thanks very much for having me. And it's great to share, and maybe some of these things will work out great. Maybe some of them won't, but you just got to get out there and try and make some attempts to push your own boundaries. That's what I try and communicate to people, which is, look, I'm not a Nobel laureate smart guy. I'm not an Olympic athlete caliber kind of person. I'm just persistent, and I just look at things very practically. And I think everybody has that potential. I think the greatest tragedy of the human condition is that people self-limit themselves. They don't think that they can do extraordinary things, and they can. It just takes work, and it takes dedication and persistence. But anybody can do what I do with enough time and attention, I think.
Yeah.
Well, those are good words to close on. I appreciate that. So, yeah. All right. Thanks again, Victor.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. There you have it. Our chat with Victor Vescovo. Thanks to Victor for sitting in on that one and being such a gracious guest. And also a big thanks to our buddy, David Concannon, who's a mutual friend, actually connected us with Victor, was kind enough to suggest him as a guest, and it all worked out really well. And you know, you said at the top before we got into the chat that he's a completionist, and boy, the guy just, you know, for someone who you kind of imagine being a bit of a kind of a type A personality, kind of a go-getter, he's a pretty chill guy. Like, it was a really pleasant talk, and there wasn't a lot of swagger to him. I mean, he's definitely confident, but I kind of like his vibe, and it was really great to talk to him. And then I have to throw this out there. I was a little hesitant to admit this, but when I was writing my first novel, Depth Charge, I needed someone in my mind to picture as my villain, rousing, and it was Victor Vescovo. So if you've read Depth Charge and you can remember my villain rousing, Victor Vescovo is the person I had in mind, with the ponytail and the whole bit and even the big expensive ship. So anyway, I hope Victor takes that well when he listens to this, and I'll have to send him a copy of my book, and hopefully he's flattered and not upset by it. But that was a great chat.
Certainly doesn't come off as anything like a villain in the convo, so that's great. Super cool. And yeah, big shout out to David for connecting us with that. As always, David, your support means the world. Look, let's get into some final notes. Put a bow on it.
Yeah, definitely.
You want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, this one actually came several weeks ago from one of our Slack members named TLR. And it's a podcast episode from a podcast I think you and I both have enjoyed in the past called 99% Invisible, which has some great episodes. This one is particularly relevant to kind of our world in terms of exploration and horology. And the episode is got a little profanity in it, but you know, we'll tone it down a bit. It's Where the F Are We? And it really has to do with the history of the quest to accurately navigate by longitude. So, you know, both of us and many of us have read the Dava Sobel book called Longitude, that kind of covers the history of the development of the marine chronometer and the search for how to accurately track longitude for navigation. And this episode kind of revisits that in an audio sense, and it was just kind of fun to listen to it. They do a nice job with that podcast, and you know, thanks to TLR for bringing that up to everyone's attention. And thought I'd throw that out there on a final note because it's a good one. It's always good to run across podcasts that are kind of in our space. Besides TGN, of course. Yeah.
I mean, 99% Invisible is just like one of the best.
Yeah.
They've been going for a really long time. They're up in the 600s, I think well into the 600s in terms of episodes. They do a lovely job. Sarah and I will commonly, when we're road tripping or something like that, pick a few that we haven't listened to and kind of put them on a playlist and do that. They do a great job. And I just think there's a great story. Obviously, it's a fantastic book, which you mentioned by Dava Sobel, but there's a great story behind the pursuit of this and the various different, like, elements of science at the time, whether it was astronomy or timekeeping or otherwise, that were all thought they had a solution.
Yeah.
It's a good one for sure.
Yeah.
And
what do you have?
Yeah. So for mine this week, with all of my travel recently, I've been using a little tool that I got for about $15 on Amazon. It's called the Nextool Mini Sailor Lite, and it's a travel allowed multi-tool. I've had the misfortune of having a more expensive version of something. I can't remember exactly which one of the Leatherman is, you know, doesn't have a knife and is supposed to be TSA. I've had that taken away in the past and I just never replaced it.
Oh yeah.
It was kind of expensive. It was a nice thing, or more expensive than say $15, which is like $11 US, I think. I think it looks like the standard price for this Nextool is $20, but it's just a little simple fold out kind of version of a multi-tool. It has a pair of pliers, it has a pair of scissors, it has a couple of little screwdrivers, it has a bottle opener, which is nice to have. And then the one that's kind of handy for nerds that might be listening to this is it has a SIM eject tool that's actually quite sturdy.
That's pretty cool.
And I've used it to size bracelets, like to change the micro adjusts on a bracelet.
Great idea.
Which is actually quite nice to have.
Yeah.
So far I've had it in my bag and only one time has somebody pulled it out and asked me to open up every tool.
Yeah.
But that's one time. I've probably flown with it 5 or 6 trips so far, in the last little while. And at $15, if I get a guy or gal at, security that absolutely doesn't want to accept it, it's not something where I'm going to go, well, I'm going to go back to the other side of the line and try and ship it or something like that. I'll just, you just walk away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's
but it's nice enough to be useful when you get somewhere.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, it would really be a handy thing to keep in a dop kit. I always do kind of struggle with that idea of carrying
for pocket
knives. I almost resist just getting in the habit of carrying a tool because then I'm worried that I'll have it in my pocket when I go to the airport. But something like this would just be nice. It's one of those things where at this price, I wouldn't have a problem leaving it in my dop kit and seldom using it because then when you do need it, it would really come in handy. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things like in my dop kit, I also have something that I know it's there, but I don't use it that often. And that's like a tick removal knife.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
One of those little like red spoon things to remove a tick at the cottage, just so I know I'll have one with me all the time.
Right.
Just in case, because ticks are everywhere now. I was seeing signage for it in Switzerland the other day.
Wow.
I think this is a notable little thing for $15. I'm not sure that it's a $15 experience, but it's definitely not bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
The bar for a $20 like little tool knife is obviously set by Swiss Army. It's not that level of polish, but it's a nice facsimile, a nice, sort of step towards a little version of like a wingman from Leatherman.
Yeah. Good pick. Classic final note choice. Good one.
Oh yeah.
Put on the list for the stocking stuffers. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 exactly. I'll need to remember it, and I definitely won't.
Yeah.
there's a solid episode. It sounds like you had a great time chatting with Victor, which I'm pumped about, and a couple of good final notes there, and certainly a podcast you can dig into if this episode left you curious about exploring the world and how we got to a point where we could do such things, some of the amazing things that Victor's done, so... As always, thank you so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab yourself a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegreynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "The reward of a thing well done is having done it."